The Contra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eContra AI. So, think about your phone or laptop right now. How often do you actually lean on a machine translation tool? Maybe you're navigating a foreign website or trying to get the gist of a report or even just, you know, figuring out an email.
Yeah, it's constant. Tools like Google Translate or DeepL, they feel like they've always been there almost.
Right. They're not novelties anymore. They're really central to how we communicate across languages globally.
Absolutely. And the results can feel almost like magic, just instantaneous. But for our deep dive today, we're actually looking into Thierry Poibeau's work on machine translation.
Okay.
And it tells a story that's, well, it's far from magical. It's actually a history filled with struggle, some major failures, and these three really big intellectual shifts, these revolutions in how we even think about computational linguistics.
So our mission today is kind of tracing that whole journey for you. We're going from really basic word-for-word swapping back in the 50s.
Right. Very primitive stuff.
All the way to the kind of near fluency we sometimes see now.
Mm.
And ultimately, the goal is to unpack that core challenge, the one that's basically haunted computer science for like 70 years.
Mm.
How do you get a computer to actually model something as complex as human language?
That really is the heart of it. And Poibeau, who's a pretty distinguished research director, computational linguist himself, he makes this point really clearly. Translation isn't just swapping words.
Yeah.
It's about transferring meaning.
Mm.
Across different languages, different cultures, you have to navigate ambiguity, context, idioms, all that messy human stuff. It's genuinely one of the oldest and hardest problems in all of AI.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning then, the genesis of machine translation, MT. And I guess like a lot of early AI stories, this one has roots in, well, war and politics.
It does. We're talking late 1940s, 1950s. The big driver was the Cold War. The U.S. government had this huge need. They desperately wanted to translate massive amounts of Russian scientific documents and fast.
Right.
And the initial thinking was kind of, well, simplistic. They thought language was basically like a code. If you could just figure out the rules, write them down, you could crack it.
And that optimism, that kind of thinking, led straight to that famous Georgetown IBM experiment. Back in 1954.
Oh, yeah. That was a huge deal. Really high profile. They managed to translate something like 60 simple Russian sentences into English. Mm. And the result wasn't just, hey, this works. It was this explosion of optimism.
Like they thought they'd solved it.
Pretty much. Researchers genuinely believed fully automated, high-quality translation was maybe just 3 to 5 years away. So naturally, funding poured in.
But the actual technology they were using,
yeah,
what we now call rule-based machine translation, or RBMT, that ran into a bit of a wall, didn't it? A really fundamental one.
A massive wall. The whole rule-based idea was built on this notion of, let's say, linguistic elegance. You try to explicitly write down every single grammatical rule, every exception, list all the vocabulary.
Yeah.
They had different flavors, like transfer systems, which would analyze the source language structure and then try to generate the target language structure. And then the even more ambitious interlingua systems.
Interlingua. That's fascinating. What was the core idea there?
The dream was a universal language, like a language of pure meaning, independent of any specific human language. You'd translate the source sentence into this abstract representation, this interlingua.
Like a language of thought.
Exactly. And then you translate that pure meaning into whatever target language you wanted. The goal was incredibly ambitious. Solve translation once and for all for any language pair.
That sounds beautiful conceptually, like linguistically elegant, as you said.
Mm.
But I'm guessing the practical reality was messy.
Utterly impossible. It turned out human language is just far too complex, too irregular. It's full of exceptions, idioms, nuances, things that no team of linguists, no matter how brilliant, could ever fully capture in a perfect set of rules.
So the systems were fragile.
Incredibly brittle. If the input sentence didn't perfectly match the rules they'd programmed, the system would just break.
Right.
Often spectacularly, gibberish output.
And all that failure, that sort of collective dead end, it had real consequences, didn't it? Culminating in that infamous 1966 ALPAC report.
Oh, yes, that report, commissioned by the U.S. government. And it was just a gut punch to the whole field. Its conclusion was brutal. Machine translation was slower, less reliable, and actually more expensive than just hiring human translators.
Ouch.
The impact was huge. Funding basically dried up overnight. It triggered what many call the first AI winter, specifically for MT research. Progress just stopped for decades, really.
Okay, but here's where the story gets really interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because the field didn't just die. It sort of reinvented itself. It went through this first massive paradigm shift. In the 1990s, researchers, especially some frustrated folks from IBM, essentially said, okay, fine. If we can't teach the computer all the rules of grammar...
Let's just forget grammar altogether.
Exactly. It was a radical move.
Yeah.
This was the birth of statistical machine translation, SMT. A total philosophical turnaround. They moved away from linguistics, away from symbolic rules, and embraced information theory and probability.
Right.
The big realization was, stop trying to teach the computer grammar. Instead, let the computer learn language by looking at vast amounts of text that had already been professionally translated. Translation became a stats problem.
So instead of asking, what's the grammatically correct translation, the question became, based on all this data, what's the most likely translation for this chunk of words?
Precisely. And for that whole statistical approach to have any chance, it needed fuel. Massive amounts of fuel. The absolutely crucial ingredient was the parallel corpus. Okay, explain that. What's a parallel corpus?
Poirbeau uses a great example. The Canadian Hansard. That's the official record of the Canadian Parliament, and it's meticulously kept in both English and French.
So millions of sentences. Perfectly aligned.
Millions upon millions. High-quality professional translations. That kind of data became the bedrock. The quantity and quality of the parallel data was suddenly paramount.
So, okay, how does this statistical method actually work then? If they ditched the grammar rules, what stopped the output from just being word soup?
Clever, right. They used two key models working together but separately. First, you have the translation model. Its job is purely statistical alignment. It looks at the source language chunk and the target language chunk and calculates the probability that they correspond. It learns through sheer repetition in the data that the White House is a very probable translation of La Maison Blanche.
Okay, so that's like sophisticated pattern matching based on frequency. What's the other model?
That's the language model. This one is kind of like an internal editor, a fluency checker. Critically, it only looks at the target language. It ignores the source text completely.
Really?
Yep. Its only job is to ask, how likely is this sequence of words in English or French or whatever the target is? It ensures the output sounds like a real sentence. It learns that the White House is vastly more probable English than House the White.
That makes sense. Combining the what words match probability with the does this sound right probability.
Exactly. And the real breakthrough within SMT, the thing that made it genuinely useful, was phrase-based SMT.
Why was translating chunks, phrases, instead of single words such a big step up?
Because it tackled the word order problem head on. Think about translating between English and, say, German or Japanese. The word order can be completely different. A phrase-based system could learn that the English phrase on the table, three words, corresponds to the equivalent phrase in German, maybe auf dem Tisch, even if the internal words don't align one-to-one or the order is different. It captured those larger patterns. This led to much more natural-sounding translations, much better flow. And this phrase-based SMT, well, that powered tools like Google Translate right through the early 2010s.
Okay, which brings us neatly to the second revolution, and maybe the one most people listening have actually noticed happening. The shift to neural machine translation, NMT, using deep learning. That kicked off around the mid-2010s.
Yep.
And I remember that. It felt like overnight, Google Translate went from being, I don't know, a bit clunky, maybe a C student, to suddenly being surprisingly competent, like a B-plus intern almost. What technically caused that sudden dramatic jump?
It was the move to neural networks, so specifically a design called the encoder-decoder architecture. The big difference with NMT is that it's end-to-end, meaning you basically just feed it the pairs of sentences, the parallel corpus again, and the neural network figures out all the necessary steps itself. It learns the transformations automatically. You don't need separate translation models and language models like SMT did. It's all integrated.
And this is where we get that really mind-bending concept, the thought vector, right? How does the system actually do that?
Okay, so the encoder part of the network reads the entire source sentence. But instead of trying to translate word by word or phrase by phrase, it compresses the meaning, the semantics, the context, everything into a dense mathematical representation. A vector, a set of numbers in a high-dimensional space.
So wait, it's not just matching words anymore. It's trying to capture the sentence's core meaning numerically.
Exactly. That's the context vector, sometimes called the thought vector.
Yeah.
It's a fundamentally different way of thinking about it compared to counting word pairs in SMT.
Okay, so what does the decoder do?
The decoder then takes that compressed vector, that abstract representation of meaning, and uses it to generate the translation, word by word, in the target language. It's essentially translating the idea captured in the vector, not just translating the original sequence of words or phrases.
That sounds powerful. But you mentioned a limitation with early NMT.
Yeah, the initial versions had a bottleneck problem, trying to cram the entire meaning of a really long, complex sentence into one single fixed-size vector. Well, information got lost. Quality dropped off noticeably for longer sentences.
Ah. And Poibeau's book highlights the key innovation that unlocked NMT's real potential, the attention mechanism. How does that work?
Okay, this is really clever. The attention mechanism allows the decoder, as it's generating each word in the target sentence, to sort of look back at the entire source sentence.
Look back.
Yeah, and computationally pay attention to the specific parts of the source sentence that are most relevant for predicting the next target word. So if it's translating word 10, it might focus heavily on source words 3 and 4, for example.
So it's not relying solely on that single compressed vector anymore.
Yeah.
It can dynamically focus on relevant input words.
Exactly. It effectively distributes the meaning representation across the source sentence rather than forcing everything through that one bottleneck vector. It allows the model to handle much longer, more complex sentences effectively.
And the impact was obvious. Google switching fully to NMT in 2016.
Yeah.
That was like a global demonstration, wasn't it?
It absolutely validated the whole neural approach. Overnight, translation quality for many language pairs, especially those with similar structures, improved dramatically. It showed the incredible power you get when you combine these sophisticated neural architectures with truly massive data sets.
So if the quality is so much better now, are we basically there? The challenge is solved. What does Poibeau say about the current limits? Where do these powerful systems still stumble?
He's quite clear on this. These NMT systems are phenomenal pattern matchers, brilliant even. But they aren't conscious understanders. They don't have real-world knowledge or common sense. And that means they still fail, sometimes quite badly, when the context gets tricky or ambiguous or when that common sense is needed.
So what are the big practical limitations that still hold them back from, say, perfect fluency or understanding?
Well, there are a few key ones. First, low-resource languages. NMT needs data, tons of it. If a language doesn't have a huge parallel corpus available,
like the Canadian Handcert example.
Right. If you don't have that kind of data, the NMT quality just won't be very good. It remains a major challenge. Second is domain adaptation.
Meaning?
A system trained mostly on, say, news articles will perform terribly if you suddenly ask it to translate legal contracts. Or poetry,
yeah.
Or medical notes. The language patterns, the vocabulary, the style, they're just too different from the training data.
Makes sense. And the third?
The common sense gap. They fail when resolving ambiguity requires understanding the real world. Things humans do instantly using context, these systems often get wrong because they're just matching statistical patterns.
And talking about performance, how do we even measure how good these translations are? If it's not just about grammar rules anymore.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. The standard automated metric is the BLEU score. DLEU stands for Bilingual Evaluation Understudy.
Okay.
Basically, it compares the machine's output translation against one or more human-generated reference translations. It measures the overlap of words and short phrases and grams.
So it's checking if the machine used similar words to the humans.
Pretty much. It's useful for engineers during development, you know, for quick automated checks. But Poibeau points out, and most experts agree, it's pretty flawed as a measure of true quality.
Why flawed?
Because it mainly rewards surface-level similarity. It doesn't really capture nuance or style or cultural appropriateness very well. A translation could get a high BLEU score but still sound awkward or miss the real meaning.
And thinking about the data these systems learn from, there's a significant ethical dimension too, right? Something about bias.
Oh, absolutely. This is crucial. MT systems aren't objective, neutral tools. They learn from the vast amounts of human language data we feed them.
And human language, isn't always neutral.
Far from it. If the training data contains societal biases, for instance, consistently associating certain jobs only with men or certain characteristics only with specific groups, the MT system will learn those patterns.
And potentially amplify them.
Yes, it can definitely amplify those stereotypes in its translations. It's a stark reminder that the bias isn't magically in the algorithm itself. It's reflecting the biases present in our own language and society, captured in the data.
So looking ahead then, what does Poirbeau see as the future role for machine translation? Is it about replacing human translators eventually?
No, he's very clear on this, and it's a really important takeaway. He argues strongly that MT's greatest success, its most valuable role, is in augmenting human translators, not replacing them.
Augmenting.
The future he sees, and the reality now in many professional settings, is collaboration. Let the machine handle the sheer volume, do the heavy lifting, produce that quick first draft.
Okay.
But then humans step in for what's called post-editing. They refine the machine's output. They handle the crucial final steps, ensuring nuance, creativity, cultural appropriateness, checking for those subtle errors that require real-world understanding, especially for important or high-stakes content.
So humans remain essential for that final quality check. The cultural bridge.
Absolutely. For anything where accuracy, style, and cultural context really matter.
You know, looking back at this whole journey,
it
really is like a miniature history of AI itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
You go from trying to codify rigid symbolic rules.
Or hit a wall.
Then pivoting to the brute force of statistical probabilities learned from data.
Which had its own limits.
And now landing in this era of deep learning, neural networks, trying to represent meaning itself in these complex geometric spaces is fascinating.
It really is. It forces you to appreciate the incredible mathematical and computational sophistication involved now. But at the same time, Poirbeau constantly reminds us to respect the fundamental limitations. These systems still don't understand in the human sense. They don't grasp culture or context deeply.
The whole field really shows how science progresses, doesn't it? When one approach, even an elegant one like the rule-based systems, fails.
You have to be willing to pivot. They moved to the empirical, data-driven solution with SMT. When that hit its ceiling, they pivoted again towards architectural complexity with NMT. It's a powerful lesson in, well, not being afraid to throw out old ideas when they stop working.
Okay, that leaves us with a final provocative thought for you, our listener, to maybe chew on. Given that the quality of machine translation seems fundamentally tied to the quality and the biases of the human language data we feed it, what is its reliance on pattern matching and its ultimate inability to resolve deep ambiguity without human help? Tell us about the limits of purely computational understanding. Could it be that the final barrier to perfect translation isn't actually the machine, but the inherent fuzziness and ambiguity of human communication itself?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.